This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, fires in Mexico are sending smoke as far north as the Dakotas, and the pine forests, which are wintering habitat for the monarch butterfly, are threatened. Indonesia's economic and political problems have major environmental consequences as natural resources are liquidated to raise cash. Poet Laurel Blossom celebrates Florida and captures emotions evoked by that special place. And on the Earth calendar, orchids are blooming in Vermont. The yellow lady slipper has just appeared to adorn the foot of the most beautiful maid in the wood. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. For weeks now, raging fires across Mexico have been destroying forests and other critical habitat. While the United States government is assisting in the effort to put the fires out, experts say it could be weeks before they are extinguished. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports on the effects the fires are having on both countries.
The fires are the result of Mexican farmers practicing an age-old process called slash and burn. This creates potash, which provides nutrients for the crops. Droughts believed to be caused by El Niño left many of these areas bone dry this spring. And when farmers set fires this year, the fires took off. So far, some 700,000 acres have been scorched since January by some 11,000 fires. Among the areas affected is the Chimalapas tropical forest in the state of Oaxaca in southern Mexico. Guillermo Castilleja is World Wildlife Fund's representative of Mexico. He's in Mexico City.
We're talking about a forested area of the size of Rhode Island that is very important in terms of the biological richness of the area. The flora and the fauna there are very unique, very special, many species you just don't find anywhere else in the world. And the fire that has affected the area has posed a major threat to some of these species. And we fear that some of these species may actually have disappeared as a consequence of this fire.
Castilleja says some of the fires are destroying underbrush in the rainforest and sparing some of the taller trees. But in some of Mexico's mountain areas, coniferous forests are being burned on a massive scale. Pine forests in central Mexico that serve as critical wintering habitat for monarch butterflies are also being burned. The butterflies winter in these forest areas, and if the pines disappear, the monarch cannot survive. Castilleja says the good news is that the butterflies have migrated north to the United States.
The forest is not completely destroyed, and of course now, being the warm season, the butterflies are not here. They will be coming back in the winter, but the forest has been affected, and we're now trying to estimate how the extent of the damage and what can be done to improve the situation by the time the butterflies come back again in the fall and the winter.
The U.S. Agency for International Development is providing more than $5 million, and the U.S. Forest Service now has personnel and firefighting equipment in place to help the 10 to 15,000 Mexicans who are battling the blazes. Until recent weeks, many of the locals had been using pails, hoses, and simple water bags. Guillermo Castilleja says federal officials need to be better prepared for such emergencies. But Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo blames the farmers for starting the fires and says the practice of slash and burn needs to be left behind. The fires spread smoke over a large section of North America. Mexico City was engulfed in a thick haze, which forced people to stay indoors and schools to close. Smoke from the fires has also been drifting north into the United States, as far west as Denver, north into the Dakotas, and east to South Carolina. Parts of Texas have been choking on the haze, with Dallas being among the city's hardest hit. That's where the Environmental Protection Agency's Region 6 is headquartered. Spokesman David Berry says the EPA has been monitoring the situation.
We have deployed 5 fine air particulate monitors across the state to give us health readings from the smoke and the haze that has been drifting north. Fortunately, the data that we're seeing from our monitors tells us that the smoke and haze are below health-based concerns, but high enough that make the state's health alert prudent.
Residents with pre-existing respiratory diseases and other afflictions were warned to avoid prolonged exposure to the haze. Officials say visits to emergency rooms have increased. Overall, David Berry says as far as he can remember, EPA has never seen a situation quite like this.
I have heard the fires and smoke characterized as the worst ever. I've heard them characterized as the worst in 50 years. But I've also heard several professionals say that the only thing that's going to extinguish these fires is a good rain. So it would appear that in this case, we're at the mercy of meteorological conditions and certainly at the mercy of the wind, because it's the wind primarily from the south this time of year that's picking up the smoke and haze and drifting it as far north as Michigan and Wisconsin.
But some experts say Mexico won't see significant rainfall until mid-July, and even then, the precipitation levels could be lower than normal, partly due, as you can already guess, to El Nino. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Ecologists tell us that everything in the natural world is connected to everything else. Recent events in Indonesia teach that environmental health in that country is connected to the global economy and to the political structure. Rich in timber, oil, and mineral resources, Indonesia consists of over 17,000 islands that stretch more than 5,000 kilometers from west to east. With a population of 209 million, comprised of about 500 ethnic groups, it is the world's fourth most populous country, behind China, India, and the United States. Curtis Runyon, assistant director of World Watch magazine, has recently written about the archipelago. He says the rainforest, second only in size to Brazil's, is in real danger of being incinerated. Monsoon rains late last fall put out some of the huge fires, but even today, 400,000 hectares are burning. Much of the destruction follows the initial lumbering done by international timber companies.
Most of these forests aren't completely clear-cut by timber companies. What they do is they go through and clear out the larger trees, and then in 20 years they plan on coming back and cutting the smaller trees, which have then grown. Well, what's happening is as they clear out these larger trees, they're thinning the forest and drying them out with the drought-like conditions that exist, and making them prone for forest fires, and they're actually setting a lot of these areas on fire to clear them for palm and eucalyptus plantations to grow larger trees more quickly, and so it's quite a problem, because many of these fires are set on purpose, and it's an ongoing cycle of environmental destruction.
Runyon says Indonesia's fisheries and reefs are also being depleted. Trawlers coming down from Japan are responsible for a lot of the problem. Overall, he sees tremendous pressure to sell off resources as the economic situation worsens.
Right now, Indonesia is in a precarious situation in terms of the global economy, because with its economic problems, one of the quick solutions that Indonesia can take is to liquidate a lot of its natural resources. A lot of international companies aren't going to face some of the problems in Indonesia that a lot of the indigenous companies will, selling off Indonesia's forests or minerals will remain profitable even though the economy is in shambles, because Indonesia needs a boost of foreign reserves at this point. So whatever can be exported out of the country will receive a lot of support from economists as the Indonesian economy continues to spiral downward.
A notorious situation exists at the Grasberg mine, which is operated by PT Freeport Indonesia, whose major owner is the American Freeport-McMoRan Copper and Gold Company. Grasberg is the world's largest open-cut gold and copper mine. It's located in Indonesia's easternmost province. Danny Kennedy is director of Project Underground. That's an international human rights organization that supports communities threatened by mining operations. In 1997, he was arrested and deported from Indonesia after taking water samples downstream of the mine in response to a community complaint that their water was contaminated. While he did not come back with the samples, he describes how PT Freeport dumps the tailings into the adjoining Agawagon River. Tailings are ground rock and residue that is left over after the ore has been extracted.
Riverine tailings disposal, as this is known, has been outlawed in the United States for about 15 years. But it's practiced there at an unimaginable scale. There's a 10-ton dump truck in your mind's eye every 5 seconds pulling up to the edge of the mine and dumping its waste into that river. That river, as a result of that, is now clogged up with the heavy sediment, as you can imagine. And downstream of the mine, about 80 kilometers away, where this fast-flowing tropical river slows down in the lowlands, the silt has dropped out into the bed of the river. It's caused the river to flood up and breach its banks. And now the river water has sheeted eastward into a large rainforest watershed catchment and has started to flood that rainforest.
Kennedy also says that over the next 40 years, the mine plans to fill in two valleys with dirt that is on top of the ore deposits. This overburden is expected to be twice the amount of earth dug to construct the Panama Canal. Freeport-McMoRan refused to be interviewed by the Environment Show, but it did release a statement about tailings disposal at the Indonesia mine. Quote, "During the life of the mine operation, the management of tailings using the river and constructed levees will cause the river to change course within the area being managed, with consequent loss of the original forest vegetation. In fact, this is the same process of meandering, overflow of banks, and flooding which occurs in all similar river systems in the area, except more so because of the additional sediment load caused by the tailings. Following mine closure, the river system will revert to natural sediment transport and deposition." End quote. Observers say major economic enterprises have flourished in Indonesia when they've had close connections with relatives of the recently deposed chief of state Suharto. PT Freeport is no exception and has been Indonesia's single largest taxpayer. Now that the government has changed, new economic relationships are being sorted out, but continued overexploitation of Indonesia's resources seem to be accepted as a fact of life and a source of foreign exchange needed to bolster Indonesia's precarious economy. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is a national production, and it's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. If you have comments about Mexico, Indonesia, or any place else, give us a call. The number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email is green at wamc.org. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For poet Laurel Blossom, her special place is Florida. She's from New York and is committee member of the YMCA's National Writer's Voice.
Laurel, you have written about Florida, a place that inspires emotion and reaction. One of the things you wrote about is experiences that people have there. What was going on when you wrote questions for couples aboard the Ocean Lady?
Well, there were several things going on. I spent a good deal of time in Florida when I was a girl, and I'm an enthusiastic Florida fan. Things have happened in Florida since I was a girl that are disturbing a little bit. You know, the environment's been affected, and that shows up in several of these poems that I'm going to read today. And the ocean has been affected, and that was part of what was going on. The form of the poem comes from an exercise that I did at a writer's conference, actually, in Florida at New Smyrna Beach at the Atlantic Center for the Arts. And the person I was working with suggested that we write this poem in the, sort of in the form of a questionnaire. Questions for couples aboard the Ocean Lady. Have you ever been deep-sea fishing before? If so, what is the biggest fish you ever caught? Did you eat it? Did you stuff it? How much did it weigh? Can you get it in restaurants back home? Where do you come from? Are you staying down here the whole winter? Do you own or rent? What is your line of work? Do you get seasick? If so, not. Did you bring your Dramamine? Lunch? How far out do you want to go? Do you want to see the water change color in the Gulf Stream? Do you want to take the wheel? Would you like me to call you Skipper? Shall we try to avoid the algae blooms or not? Do you have a seashore where you come from? Have the beaches ever been closed? For what reasons? Bad weather? Red tide? Used needles? Other?
And in addition to the experience that one has fishing in Florida, one also has experiences with companions. And that, I take it, led you to write the poem Fight. Give
Correct.
Us a little bit of background on this one.
Well, my now husband had at that time asked me to marry him, and I was having a struggle saying yes. And so the differences between our personalities came up in a big way, and that's what led to the poem. It's called Fight. That is the difference between me and you. You pack an umbrella, number 30 sun goo, and a red flannel shirt. That's not what I do. I put the top down as soon as we arrive. The temperature's trying to pass 55. I'm freezing, but at least I'm alive. Nothing on earth can diminish my glee. This is Florida, Florida, land of euphoria, Florida in the highest degree. You dig in the garden, I swim in the pool. I like to wear cotton, you like to wear wool. You're always hot, I'm usually cool. You want to get married, I want to be free. You don't seem to mind that we disagree, and that is the difference between you and me.
And presumably, despite those differences, a desire to be in Florida continues. Is that what inspired the work Florida itself?
Well, as I said, I spent a good deal of time in Florida when I was a girl. My great-grandfather was one of the early pioneers in Palm Beach, and so we used to spend spring vacations down there a lot. And then there were many years when I didn't have an opportunity to go to Florida, and I realized at some point about 10 years ago that I really missed it, and I really wanted to be there. And this poem actually was one of the things that helped me to understand in an emotional way how much Florida meant to me. I'm very enthusiastic about Florida, and I wanted to write a poem that would show that enthusiasm. So the humor and the rhyme in this poem, I thought, sort of gave it that that enthusiastic edge.
Let's hear it.
Okay. Florida. I want to live in Florida. The trade winds blow. If there's a storm, there's a storm, and then it's over. The Gulf Stream flows. There are always ships on the ocean. You can think about where they go. Let's all move down to Florida. Listen to the palm trees sway, smell the orange blossoms, drive through the Everglades. When I see my next flamingo, I want it to be alive. Oh, God's penis. How he must adore it to have adorned it so, with coconuts and castanets, rum and pompano, the condos, the casinos, the rocket ships, and Key West dripping off the indefatigable tip forever. What are we waiting for? Salt air's good for the skin, and you'll be a different person in the presence of a pelican. And that torrid little climate, you'll adore it every time it climbs up your sublime Floridian shore.
We've been talking with Laurel Blossom, a poet from New York, who obviously sees a lot in Florida. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. June has arrived, which means orchids are beginning to bloom in Vermont. They can be found at the Eshqua Bog, located in the south-central part of the state. It's near the town of Woodstock. The bog is about 40 acres in size, but the orchids are mainly confined to an 8-acre area. Thelma Hewitt is with the New England Wildflower Society. It's the oldest plant conservation society in the country. She says yellow lady slippers are among the orchids which are blooming right now.
They're about 8 or 10 inches tall, have little yellow slipper pouches, and normally grow in wet places in woods with a limey soil. They don't like acid areas. They're very pretty, and in certain places you get great colonies of them, and in Eshqua we get a few scattered around. It's not common that you find many yellow lady slippers and showy lady slippers growing together, but in Eshqua, the next species that comes along are the showy lady slippers, which are very dramatic. They're well named because they're about 2.5 feet tall, have very large pink and white blossoms.
Thelma Hewitt says the blossom of the yellow lady slipper ranges from about 0.5 inch to 2 inches in diameter. It really depends on the fertility of the soil. Their leaves are similar to the lily of the valley, about 2 to 3 inches wide and 6 inches long. She says there are two other orchids that bloom in the Eshqua Bog, and they're less noticeable.
These are two little, almost grass-like ones. One is called the northern green orchis, and another is called the bog orchis, northern bog orchis. One is white and one is a pale green, and they grow to be about a foot or two tall, but the blossoms are only about 0.5 inch long, so they're almost inconspicuous, insignificant, except that when you see a group of them here and there scattered throughout, it's one more bit of beauty in the bog.
Hewitt says both are members of the orchid family, but are actually called orchis, which refers to their genus. She says deer and rabbits like to feed on the orchids, but other than providing food for wildlife, these orchids aren't grown commercially. Their need for specific soil conditions make them difficult to use in commercial production and in landscaping. Untamable, then, they're a special treat for visitors to the bog. But even though it's called a bog, it isn't really a bog. It's actually something called a fen.
A fen is a wetland that was formed back in the days of the glaciers. I guess the glacier melted and left this great hole, and the water collected there. And in a bog, the only way additional water would come into such a hole would be from rain or snow. But in a fen, there is water moving in and moving out. That's the difference between the two. And so in Eshqua Bog, which is really a fen, the water does come in from a hillside, and there is some groundwater, some bubbling springs that come up and bring nutrients up into the bog.
But if the bog is actually a fen, one wonders whether it should be called Esquifen. Wouldn't it be more fun to have fun in the fen? But then would people want to visit a fen? Would they be offended? Maybe, maybe they should just stay stuck in the bog. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, the wolves of Denali National Park in Alaska. We meet the scientist who studied them for 9 years. We talk green about an environmental problem in the homes of many of us. It's lead. What should you do to protect your children and yourself? A green tip on bats in your belfry. And listeners comment on our coverage of the environment in China and our discussion about asthma. Stay with us. In 1985, the National Park Service began studying the wolves of Denali National Park in Alaska. They're considered to be the world's least disturbed mainland wolf population, a population which is now stable. Research is continuing on a scaled-back level today, but information gathered over the first 9 years of the program has been compiled in a new book titled The Wolves of Denali. Dr. David Meech took part in the project and is co-author of the new book. Meech is a senior scientist with the Biological Resources Division of the U.S. Geological Survey. He's studied wolves with the federal government for the past 30 years. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott recently spoke with Dr. Meech about the wolves of Denali.
For our listeners who may be unfamiliar with the Denali National Park in Alaska, maybe you could give us a picture of what it's like there and perhaps of its massive size.
Well, Denali National Park used to be known as Mount McKinley National Park because it's dominated by Mount McKinley, which, of course, is the highest mountain in North America. And the park is located in central Alaska, about midway between the cities of Anchorage and Fairbanks. And it covers an area of close to 10,000 square miles. The Mount McKinley itself, what they call the McKinley Mastiff, really covers an area about 50 miles by 100 miles in terms of the base of the mountain itself. It's just a huge set of mountains with Mount McKinley dominating the whole system.
Besides the concern of illegal poaching of the wolves, the National Park Service began the research to understand the relationship between the wolves in Denali and caribou. Can you talk about this a little?
Yes. Wolves prey on three different species of hoofed animals in Denali, the Dall sheep, the moose, and the caribou. And yet the Park Service really had little information about what the population of wolves as a whole lived on in the park. That is, to what extent did they prey on caribou? To what extent did they rely on moose and that kind of thing? And the Park Service also really did not have a good inventory of the number of wolves in the park or even the number of packs. 9,000 to 10,000 square miles is a pretty large area to gather information in, and so they really had very little idea about what was going on with the wolves or between the wolves and their prey species. Our study involved primarily looking at the wolf population itself and then the role of the caribou in the food habits of the wolf and how the caribou population related to the numbers of wolves in the park.
From what I understand, about 150 wolves were radio collared. About how many wolves total are there in the Denali area?
Well, in the park itself, the actual numbers varied over the years from 50 to around 150, and that depends on specifically what part of the park you're talking about and that kind of thing. But the point is they fluctuated greatly over the nine-year period of the study itself.
Adolf Murie's studies of the Denali wolves in the 1940s contributed greatly to your knowledge of the wolves. But how did the tools he used to monitor them compare with the equipment your research team used?
Well, Murie did a great job for the time in which he was working, but the best tools he had really were a dog team and a set of binoculars and a notepad. I mean, that's all there were available, really. And when we began our study, we had the advantage of having radio collars, which are a fairly recent invention, and used aircraft, helicopters, and fixed-wing planes, drugs we used to dart the wolves with, and we used genetic analyses that depended on DNA analysis and that kind of thing. So we had a lot of technological advantages over when Murie was doing his work.
Is there illegal harvesting of the wolves in Denali today?
Well, the actual take by humans in the first place in Denali is legal. There are provisions for taking wolves in a large part of the park or in preserve, and yet there's few people interested in doing so. We estimated that less than 2% of the Denali wolf population was killed by humans each year. And that would be both legal and illegal, but most of it would have been legal taking. But again, it was less than 2% of the population per year. So essentially, Denali was about as natural a wolf population as you could get.
What are some of the most interesting wolf characteristics or behaviors that surfaced from your research or studies?
Well, one of the things that was really driven home to us was the great degree of fluctuation in the social organization of the wolf population. Wolf packs were often killing members of other packs. A pack would flourish for a few years in an area and then die out. Other new packs would form. There was just a great deal of flux in the social organization of those wolves in the park, even though this state of flux was driven by natural factors, not by human factors.
Dr. David Meach is co-author of a new book titled The Wolves of Denali. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. Dr. Meach, thank you for joining us.
Well, you're quite welcome.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're talking about lead and the environment and how it relates to you and your children's health and what you can do to protect your family from lead poisoning. Lead poisoning has been around a long time. There are Roman emperors who are alleged to have gone mad by drinking wine from lead goblets, And I've seen the bones of early settlers in colonial Maryland, which were deformed because they got their drinking water through lead pipes. And interestingly, the bones of their slaves buried next to them are straight and strong because, of course, the slaves had to drink out of a creek nearby. In our time, we've seen high levels of lead in children's blood, and I presume that as a society, we're going to be coping with some of the difficulties that that's presented for years to come. And so, again, we're talking about lead in the environment, your family's health, and if you have comments, give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN. My guests today are Claudette Grant, and she is the acting chief of the Program Services section of the lead branch of the Federal Center for Disease Control. Also with us is Ann Guthrie. She's deputy director of the Alliance to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, which is a nonprofit organization in Washington. So, Claudette Grant from CDC, let's start with you. How much of a problem is lead poisoning with us in the United States today?
Incidentally, lead remains a problem in the United States. We know that we have houses that were built prior to 1950. Unfortunately, that as time goes on, the paint, lead paint, has started to deteriorate and cause issues for our children. We have had dramatic decreases over the years since the 70s. We've seen levels go in 76 to 80. From 15 micrograms per deciliter down to 2.7 micrograms per deciliter in 1991 and 94.
Now, these are micrograms per deciliter in what? In people's blood?
That's correct, blood. Particularly in these particular levels are blood lead levels in children.
And let me ask you something before we get to Ann Guthrie about what we could do about this. Am I right in understanding that there really is no safe level, that any level at all in a child's blood causes damage? Is that right?
I'm sorry. I thought you were referring to Ann.
Right. No, Claudette, is that right? I mean, is the CDC tell us that any level at all is dangerous?
What we know is that, in fact, that lead provides no biological benefit to humans to humans. And, in fact, what we recommend, sort of a threshold, if you would, is a blood lead level of 10 micrograms per deciliter or higher. Anything above that provides a concern for us. We know that, in fact, at least at those levels, that there are harmful effects that children have in terms of learning and behavior.
I see. So, Anne, what can we do about this, or what should families be thinking about in order to protect their children today?
Well, there are still a variety of lead sources in our environment, but as Claudette indicated, the principal source of childhood lead poisoning today is lead dust from deteriorated lead-based paint in older homes. Because lead-based paint was used so widely, there is now lead-based paint in some two-thirds of the American housing stock. The good news is that as long as the paint is in good condition and intact, there's probably nothing to worry about. However, you might want to take some precautions if your paint is deteriorated or if you're undertaking any renovation projects that might stir up paint dust.
So in many ways, this is the ultimate environmental issue because the environment is your home and it's contaminated by what may be coming out of the paint in the walls.
That's right. Most Americans today spend most time indoors, and that's particularly true for young children. The youngest children are the most vulnerable to lead neurotoxic effects, and because most children are exposed to the lead dust by normal hand-to-mouth behavior, that is, they crawl around on the floor, they get lead dust on their fingers, their toys, their pacifiers, and they put those in their mouths, young children can be exposed at disproportionate levels to whatever dust is in their indoor environment.
And I guess we're talking about really small amounts of dust. You don't have to have this stuff an inch thick on the floor to
have
a problem.
That's right. The quote that we often hear is that it only takes about the equivalent of 3 grains of salt per day to poison a young child.
Wow. And I don't think even the most fastidious housekeeper can keep their house that clean.
No, that's right.
Before we talk about ways to stop all of this, and I'd like advice from either one of you, what is the effect of lead at elevated levels on the child or on any of us? What does it do to your body or your mind?
Claudette, you want to go?
Sure. at higher levels, if you would, particularly levels as high as 70 micrograms per deciliter, you'll have issues around seizures, comas, and possibly even death. At some of the lower levels, there are issues around mental retardation, behavioral problems, and learning disabilities.
And when you say behavioral problems, what kind of things come to your mind when you say that?
I believe some of the studies may have indicated issues around perhaps attention and ability to take in information that's provided in school, etc.
Do you know whether politicians in high national office also have problems with having been exposed to lead?
No, I don't. I'm not.
Do you recommend that we have a lead test as a criteria for office? So this is a broad range of problems, and I gather that sometimes they're not always readily apparent. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what do you tell parents about whether they suspect or wonder about whether their children are being affected by lead poisoning?
Right. The challenge is that lead poisoning often doesn't present the kinds of symptoms that would cause you to suspect that there's a problem. The only way to diagnose lead poisoning is with a blood lead test. And for that reason, there are recommendations in place to routinely screen young children for lead poisoning. And because risk for lead poisoning varies across the country, those recommendations are not uniform, but we do know that children who are enrolled in Medicaid, who are currently required to be tested for lead poisoning, and children who live in other high-risk areas or in old housing should be screened for lead poisoning.
Now, a lot of us live in old houses or in apartments that are old, and we decide that it's time to spruce the place up. We get the sandpaper out. We start sandpapering the old paint. That's not a good idea. What do you recommend with respect to the question of household renovation if one knows that there's lead on the windowsills?
Right. In fact, you don't even need to know whether or not there's lead in the windowsills. What you need to know is how to work lead safe. And fortunately, that's simple and it's inexpensive. What I would recommend is that anyone undertaking any repainting or renovation projects think consciously about not creating a lot of dust. Instead of scraping, you just take a little mister and wet it down so you're scraping wet and try and contain the dust. So there are a number of simple steps that people can take. And the way to get started is to start to learn about what kinds of things can create lead hazards. There is a national lead information hotline where you can call to get basic information. And that number is 1-800-LEAD-FYI. And they will send you a package of general information as well as information about where to go for more complex questions.
Now, I know another problem that the home renovator runs across is if they don't sand, you can always get the benzomatic torch and try burning paint off. What does that do?
That's also a bad idea.
Right.
There are a list of about five common practices which HUD has actually banned in its properties because they are so unsafe. You don't want to use a belt sander. You don't want to use a propane torch or a heat gun to burn off lead paint. It can create toxic fumes. You don't want to do dry scraping or dry sanding in an indoor environment where you're creating a lot of dust.
Now, one of the things that people frequently say is, well, I may have a problem, so I'll simply paint over what is there.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
It's, in and of itself, it's probably not a problem. What the issue is to determine whether or not the underlying surface is intact. If the paint is peeling because there's a window leaking, then whatever paint you put on there isn't going to hold. If you can fix the underlying problem and put a new coat of paint on there that stays intact, you probably have nothing to be concerned about.
Now, Claudette, there has been some federal legislation that covers what people do when they buy or sell a home or rent, specifically related to lead. Can you fill us in on that?
Right. And I may ask my colleague on the other end to actually chime in as well. You're referring to what's called Title 10 disclosure. I believe at its simplest description, it is that as a person purchases a home, they are supposed to have disclosed to them from the seller any information that or information dealing with their home around lead paint, i.e., I believe it includes information on the age of the house and whether or not, to their knowledge, there is the presence of lead paint. And I believe both buyer and seller signs off on that disclosure.
That's right. Yeah, that's correct. And I should just add that it goes beyond people buying older homes. It applies to anyone buying or renting property that was built before 1978, and in addition to disclosing any known information about lead paint in the property, the owner of the property is also supposed to provide a general informational brochure that provides the kind of information that we're talking about today.
And that's a brochure, I think, that's provided by the federal government, by HUD. Am I right about that?
Yes, it was developed by the EPA and the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and it is widely available.
My recollection is that there's another provision that says after you sign the contract or the lease, the purchaser or the renter is given a certain amount of time to get the place tested if they want to, and if they find lead, they can then back out.
It's sort of true. This only applies to purchases. This one does not apply to rentals. And the best model to think of is a home inspection. If a buyer is interested and concerned about lead hazards, you have the option of putting something in your contract to make your contract dependent on the outcome of a lead evaluation. And then you do have, by federal law, 10 days to get that evaluation done. And if you're not happy or can't reach an agreement with the seller, you do have the right to cancel the contract.
We don't have a lot of time left, but let's move out of the home and look at the environment generally. We've taken lead out of gasoline, therefore I presume there's less in the air. Are there other major sources of lead in the American environment now that come from places other than the paint that's chipping off our old homes?
In the external environment, domestically, we still do have a number of soil and dust areas which were contaminated by prior leaded gasoline use. Once the lead is in the environment, it doesn't degrade or decay. It's just there. We also still have some industrial problems in certain areas we call point sources where manufacturing operations may contaminate environments.
Are we still getting it out of smokestacks, for example, in industrial plants?
There are regulations in place to control those, but nothing is perfect. And some areas continue to have problems with those.
And so generally, looking at the whole issue of environmental health in a broader sense, is it fair to say that the new sources are pretty well stopped and we've now got to worry about what's already out there? Is that a fair way of looking at this, or do we still have new sources that have to be stopped?
That's pretty fair domestically. Your listeners may be interested to know that overseas, leaded gasoline continues to be used widely. There are only about a dozen countries worldwide that have completely phased out leaded gasoline, and that continues to be the largest source of new lead contamination as well as lead poisoning worldwide.
So when I go to Bangkok in the streets, I should not breathe because I'm going to get a lot.
That's pretty much right.
Okay, I'm afraid our time is up, and we've been speaking about lead in the environment, a ubiquitous contaminant. Claudette Grant has been with us from the Center for Disease Control and Ann Guthrie from the Alliance to End Childhood Lead Poisoning. We're interested in your comments. Give us a call, 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Your environmental concerns are of concern to us. Write us at The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Email is green@wamc.org.
This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world and yourself in your everyday life. Bats are everywhere. They're an important part of the natural world, and they control bug populations by eating millions of pounds of insects every year. Occasionally, they find their way into our homes. So what do you do if you have bats in the belfry? The Fund for Animals says, first, don't panic. Normally, they won't bite. And if no one has been bitten, confine the animal to one room and open a window. The bat should find its way out. In the rare event that someone is bitten, capture the animal so health officials can test it for rabies. You can capture the bat by placing a jar over it when it lands. Slide a piece of paper or cardboard or strong paper underneath the jar so the bat can't escape. Good luck. Or using thick gloves, place a towel over the beast and pick it up. Always avoid direct contact with the bat itself. Once you have the animal in a secure jar or container, call your local health department. That's our green tip for this week. And now it's time to hear what listeners to the Environment Show have been telling us. Here's Rachel Phillips.
Thanks, Peter. Our first caller heard we were airing a story on the environment and China. Dave Kolb called in to say that he traveled the country recently, specifically the areas of Beijing, Xi'an, and Shanghai. He says the differences among the regions are amazing.
Pretty consistently, though, the quality of the air is really bad. They burn a lot of coal, so there's a lot of particulate, and it's just, you know, when you hear about some of the major cities in the world, the air pollution is pretty predominant throughout China, and it's one of those things you really notice.
Dave Kolb says he has to give the government of China credit for trying to raise the quality of life for such a huge population. Most of the calls to our listener comment line recently focused on a Talking Green discussion about asthma. John Bethune says, we failed to address the issue of microwave transmission. He says there's new evidence showing a link between television, radio, and microwave oven transmissions and asthma.
There is a dramatic correlation between that and the increase in asthma. Research has just been finished in Sydney, Australia, which has shown that very low exposure around the level of 4 rads has direct correlation to increase of cellular dysfunction within living tissue.
Cynthia Weber-Gwynn also responded to the discussion on asthma. She says we have to be more careful about what we're putting into the environment.
I wish we could get the message out to people that you cannot douse your lawns and flower gardens and patios in insecticides and weed killers and expect that your children and pets and other people's children and pets will be unaffected by these highly toxic agents.
We welcome all comments and suggestions to the Environment Show. You can reach our comment line by dialing 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. For the Environment Show, I'm Rachel Phillips.
Hello, operator, I want you to be mine. Please deposit all your love and put me on the line.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If you plan to go camping in the Denali National Park in Alaska with Little Red Riding Hood, take a tape of the show. Dial 1-888-49-GREEN and order show number 440. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. Nature Sound was provided by Lang Elliott. Nature Sound Studio, www.naturesound.com. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.